galaxy lights, Coachella, lightning bolt necklaces. 2023 was the year of Scandoval. On March 3rd, one cheating scandal launched a reality TV investigation that generated hundreds of conspiracy theories, thousands of podcast episodes, and millions of dollars in revenue. I'm Jody Walker, host of An American Scandoval, one retrospective story told in three salacious parts. Listen December 26th on the Ringer Reality feed.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line with the footprint file under his arm, it's Andy Greenwald.
Never has doc review seemed so essential. Not since the glory days of Better Call Saul.
You know, I know.
Really, what else was this season of Slow Horses but an ode to old media? You know, when you printed stuff out, you photocopied it.
You went to Kinko's, yeah.
I love that. It's tactile, you know?
Andy, today we have a very special guest, Will Smith, who is essentially the creator, the showrunner, the writer of Slow Horses, one of our favorite shows over the last couple of years, certainly one of our favorite seasons of TV this year. It was in both of our top fives. Will came on to talk to us about all of season three, so this is a spoilery, although I don't think we actually got too deep into spoilers. A spoilery conversation with him and a little bit about the future of the show, which I thought we would start here because we've talked a lot about, you know, how reliably satisfying and rewarding this series is, and also how it seems to know exactly what it is, both in terms of its comic elements, its action elements, its thriller elements. For anybody who doesn't know, it's usually a 6-episode season based on one book in a series of books by Mick Herron. It's about Slow Horses, the Slough House of MI5, which is where loser spies go to be kind of sunsetted. And this office is run by Jackson Lamb, who is this really disgusting individual played by Gary Oldman. And it's got this great cast of characters. It's 6 episodes a season, like I mentioned, and just concluded its third series. Andy, the third season ended a little bit differently tonally than the last couple have, where it's basically a gunfight for about an hour. But most of the last 2 episodes are a gunfight. What did you think of the shift in tone?
Well, I think, I don't know, we didn't talk too much about it. I feel like we're pretty much in alignment. I loved the penultimate episode that we didn't talk specifically about on the pod yet, episode 305, which is sort of that sets up the gunfight and does have some violence in it and some weaponry. And then I did not expect the finale to be basically like assault on precinct, whatever the number.
Oh, yeah.
Assault on room 12B, I guess, would be the case in the show. But look, at every moment where I was like, I'm not sure if Slow Horses is really respecting concussion protocols to the same degree the NFL is, because Rivers really had a day and should probably sit the next couple of plays
out. You should watch some more AFC North games.
I think okay, that's fair.
Slow Horses takes good care of their players.
I was willing to go along with it and found myself finding it really gripping and really enjoyable because this was the Slow Horses version of this type of show. And the kind of amazing thing about this series that I'm really learning to appreciate even 3 years in and hopefully with many more years to come is just its reliability and its dependability. Not just that it hopefully we'll have a new book to adapt and have a new series on every fall for us. But the fact that there is a lot of road past this gives me the confidence in the creators and in the whole project that next season won't have necessarily massive machine gun fight at the end of it. It will have a different thing. And that's the sort of the beauty of the construction of the show, is that each season they can try a different type of storytelling, or almost a different type of movie. So there were a couple moments where I was like, I didn't know handguns just had unlimited bullets, like Perfect Dark on the Nintendo 64. But at the same time, that's not what I'm watching the show for.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that, I ultimately like really loved the way the season ended, just because of the notes between Tierney and Taverner and mm-hmm. Taverner and Jackson and Standish and Jackson and River and his grandfather David. Like, I thought the duos and the emotional beats really sold all the action, and the action was kind of fun. You know what I mean? Like, I really enjoy a good shoot 'em up as much as the next guy. So I thought that they did it really well, and you know, it does seem like Chieftain is going to have to do some really intense recruiting now that they're...
Well, you know, we're close to full employment post-COVID. You know, I feel like they'll be able to fill those spots.
You think that they should be going to America for new Chieftain employees?
I think they should probably go far away from any coverage of their most recent exploit. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you start a new job and you just get the same email as the person who had the job before you, and all the emails are just like, we're so sorry, we loved you so much, or like obituaries about the person, like that would be a real bummer. So I think Chieftain seriously might need to do a hard rebrand.
As far as where the series goes, I was wondering whether or not you felt the, and you know, Will talks a little bit about this, Mick Herron's books, while I wouldn't go as far to call them George R. Martin levels of merciless, I don't want to like give anything away. So I'll just say he can be disposable with his characters. Like, I think when he finds a moment that he thinks a character, the exit makes sense for the story, I think he will take that. Now, there's also that kind of like where the show exists is right in that Justified, X-Files kind of long running series. And there's going to be things that you want out of this show that they're not going to take from you for a while. And I was curious whether or not you felt, do you ever feel that itch where you're like, I want something dramatic to happen that changes everything, versus I need these people to be in Slough House together, this particular group. It's got to be Standish assisting Jackson, with River kind of bucking against it, but still staying.
No, I mean, I think it's funny that you mentioned George R. R. Martin, because I was thinking as we were sitting down to do this podcast that like Slough House, it's not a one-to-one. It's not a clear, it's not like one led to the other, but this is the promise of Game of Thrones on television again, mm-hmm. for me. You know, it's this rich world with so much runway for the creators to then build on. And the kind of moves that we've already seen in the show, the kind of volatility of people coming and going, of Ingrid being there, being gone, becoming a villain, of Spider in his arc in this season, what happened with Min, the arrival of characters like Shirley. Like, these are moves made with supreme confidence.
Yeah.
These are not the moves that even experienced or like incredibly gifted showrunners make in this way, because you just don't know what's promised. They're operating with such a stacked deck here. And I love that feeling. It is not something we're used to, really, outside of those first few seasons of Game of Thrones. We realized, wow, this is going to move at a different pace. It's going to make us uncomfortable or destabilize us in ways that we're not used to, because the natural tendency of TV is to write towards what's working and do it for as long as possible. So I think it's an interesting comparison, but a good one. I also think that, as, and we talk about this with Will in our interview, but like Gary Oldman wants to do this show forever. So mm-hmm. we do have, this is a heliocentric offense, let's say, and the sun is not burning out anytime. And so whatever other satellites you've got are worth, you know, that's pretty great. It's also worth noting that episode to episode, sometimes it's like, and Jonathan Pryce for the episodes that he's in. But I believe the only full-time recurring cast members of Slow Horses are Gary Oldman, Jack Loudon, and Kristen Scott Thomas.
Yes. And Kristen Scott Thomas is a really good example of being able to have someone of really supreme ability and just say, hey, like, I just am guessing here, but could you do a week on the show this season? Because mm-hmm. Diana is in an office languidly drinking scotch and commenting on events for the entire season.
Yeah, that's she gets just one genius walk stuff at the end.
Yeah, and then does one or two walks, like having Sofia Canedo to be able to like have this turn that she does in this season is just fantastic. You know, like the quality of the bench and that bench's belief in their coach, I guess, is really what I think makes this show pretty special.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you mentioned Sofia Canedo, who I didn't know that was her until the third episode of this season. I watch the credits every time. Like, I don't know. We've never discussed Slow Horses as I can't skip the credits show because of Mick Jagger's theme song is absolutely fantastic. But the fact that that's an actress who I've seen for 20 years in a, I assume, wig that I'm still quite surprised by, just taking such a different tone. Like, I think that me praising her is actually a way to answer your larger question, which is, I think actors see this as an opportunity, you know, which is such a great position for a show to be in. Like Sopa Dirisu, who played played Sean Donovan this season. Like when you can come to an actor like that, who's a rising actor in England, and be like, come play with us and do this sort of thing for this finite amount of time, they're going to do it. Right. It seems like an easy yes. And then you get to have, I think it's better to frame it the other way, which is like, why wouldn't Kristen Scott Thomas want to sit in a room and sip scotch with a great scene partner, knowing that they're going to come to her in 3 to 6 months and be like, guess what you got to do this year? And maybe it'll be completely different.
Right. Do you mind that this show is really just about this show? And I mean that by the way in which some spy fiction, some espionage fiction, some of these shows are about, you know, man's unknowability to man, about the sort of moral complications of nation states working on behalf of others. And there's all the kind of tropes that come up with spy fiction. And then you've got Slow Horses, which is essentially about people trying to decide like whether or not this is where they've arrived in their life and whether this is the last station that the train goes to, and being at Slough House, and whether or not the connection that they've made with the people around them is should stop their ambition and stop their sort of moving forward with their lives. But I don't really know if I would turn around and say like, yeah, Slow Horses is about England navigating a post-Brexit West or anything like that. What do you think?
I think that the way that Mick Herron in the books and the way Will Smith in the show have stacked priorities is really fantastic and really, really strong. I think that the show has such a unique positioning in that, let me put it this way. When you watch, I'm gonna use you statements, you know, which is the opposite of what I was taught in my liberal arts college. But you, Chris, when you watch a Taylor Sheridan show and you are rooting for the Special Ops or the Lioness, now I know that those shows are more morally gray area than the commercials would have you believe.
I like that, but you think the Special Ops and the Lioness are two separate things, but keep going.
Well, I'm saying, well, first I meant Special Ops as the larger genre of shows that you like, including like the, what was the SAS show, that the British one?
Rogue Heroes.
Yeah, Rogue Heroes. So that's what I meant. The larger Rogue Heroes expanded universe of types of shows.
Shows that have something, something, colon, something.
Yeah, you like shows with colons in the middle. It's fine. We all have our things. There is a kind of moral complicity in these shows that is interesting, right? But you're rooting for an institution one way or another, or you're at least not rooting for, but you are aligned with, your point of view is the institution. The thing about Slow Horses that's so smart is that they're MI5, but they're rejects from MI5. And so you can have a character like Catherine Standish in the season be like, I'm betwixt and between. I'm like, I love what I think of it, but I'm also apart from it. And so it can comment on it without being of it or responsible for it. And you can sort of dance in and out that way. And ultimately, I also think that this show is, as most good shows are, the way you said it, they're about themselves. It's about the characters. It's a workplace dramedy in a lot of ways. It's about the people that we've come to meet along the way rather than some larger political project. So it can, like, you know, it can kind of skitch along the headlines.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have a who will take over Waystar Royko engine, or who will sit on the Iron Throne engine, or who will live or who dies in White Lotus engine. But I think that it has, it's sort of a muscular version of some of the stuff that Will has worked on in the past with Armando Iannucci, which he references quite a few times in the interview people are about to hear. And I thought it was really fascinating. And I know his pedigree, but in some ways I realize like that's what I'm reacting to, or that's maybe what I'm responding to, is the VP thick of it of ness of this show.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fun to see spies, which is a type of character that you and I love more than most, be fallible. And not fallible in the, you know, well, he's a genius, but he loves to drink. You know, like not just within the realm of like Le Carre cranks, but like these guys are fuck-ups. And, you know, one of the best visual gags this season is Marcus's character, you know, has his driving around with the kid seat in the back on top of a bunch of machine guns, right? And then that scene when he and Shirley go to turn in their badges, they literally, it's like they're quitting at Arby's. They're like, well, what are we going to do with our lives now that this job is over? I really enjoy that. I think it's just a version of the story that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, me too. So I guess, why don't we get into our interview with Will?
Can I just add, before we get into it, Chris, how many of these books have you read?
I've read 5 of them.
Is it fair to say, and we sort of asked, and you'll hear in the interview, I asked Will this and he sort of alluded to some things, but he didn't spoil anything at all in the future of the series. Is my original comment kind of fair to say that like this is the action movie season of Slow Horses and that there are other types of stories to come? Or do you think season...
I think within the context of probably season 2 had more action than, you know, it's got more action than Succession ever had with the plane flying towards London and, you know, there's usually a gun in this, mm-hmm. in the series, but this definitely had the most private military, you know, the dogs, the slow horses all converging on the same space. There's a huge gunfight. So that definitely was a little bit more of an action set piece, but the next season is I think a slightly more, you know, quiet affair.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And I think also, I wonder what our listenership feels or what the fans of the show feel. Like, all the way back to the original question that you asked me when we signed on here was like, if this was a different show, I think I would have had a little skepticism or worry that the show had not lost its way, but fundamentally changed. Because most shows, again, don't have that grounding to return to. Or that the change that we're talking about is baked into its DNA. But because I trust the show so much, it's so dependable in so many ways, and talking to Will only made me feel that more so. Like, this is fun. This is a fun season.
It's a fun watch, but I do think it's honest about what the characters are doing and the world in which the characters live and that they can fuck up, you know? And I thought that was pretty interesting about the third season, where pretty much everybody who was involved in getting that file out of Istanbul dies. And that is a consequence of the way in which Dame Ingrid and Diana sort of manage their teams. It's not a management style I aspire to, but it can be cruel, you know, even though it's funny. And I think that that's that mix that really, really is its specific spice mixture.
We should get into our interview with Will Smith, who, to be clear, is the British Will Smith, not the Los Angeles Dodger or the Fresh Prince, but a Will Smith that we would love to talk to again.
Thanks to Kai McMullen for producing us. And this is the last show of the calendar year. We're recording this a little bit early, but it'll go up right after the Slow Horses finale. Hope everybody has a wonderful new year, and we will be with you in 2024 with some just outstanding content. And I don't even know what it's going to be, but I like to commit myself. It's like a New Year's resolution. Make a better pod.
Happy New Year, Baranskis. Let's talk to Will Smith about Slow Horses.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians. who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Thank you so much for joining The Watch. Andy and I have been such huge fans of this series, but this season in particular is one of the best things on television right now. And I thought we could start by talking about this specific project and something that Andy and I have been sort of fascinated by, which is, and I'm sure you're going to laugh at this, the well-oiled machine that seems to be Slow Horses, where we've gotten three seasons in 18 months. You have this roadmap with the McCarran novels where you're adapting a season per book. How do you make Slow Horses? And feel free to be as behind the scenes and inside baseball as you want, because I think Andy and I and all our listeners are fascinated.
Well, it's well-oiled, but it's a kind of relentless machine in that at any one point, there's always three of them going on at once. So there's always like one in the edit, one being prepped or shot, and one being written. At points my head is like, in a great way. But yeah, so it's, we shoot two back to back. So it takes, it's like a year shoot pretty much. By the time we finished it, or most of a year. And during that time, we'll also edit and write another one. So it's just getting it ready. So it's sort of 6 months old and then back on.
Is that why? Because I noticed in the season, you have the trailer, which we love so much. The trailer for the next season comes up at the end of the season. And in case, just to be clear, we're going to be airing this after the season three finale has aired, so we can spoil freely.
Oh, great, we can spoil everything.
I wondered if one of the reasons why every character has a different haircut is to keep, so you can keep track of which season you're looking at, whether you're looking at dailies or when you're in the edit or whatever.
It definitely helps, but it's also a nightmare if there are any pickups, because it's like, you don't look like that now. But I mean, actually, the makeup and the clothes and all praise to our amazing hair and makeup designer, Lucy Civic, and Guy Speranza, our costume designer. They really think about, and the actors as well, think about what the character's been through in the last series and how that will have moved on. You know, so Louisa, it's sort of, she's, in this series, she's got the highlights. She's trying to be up when she's down. And it really is to do with the acting of the characters, that as much as anything is, and I think the actors really like that they could kind of track where the characters are going from season to season, and they're sort of wearing the scars of what's gone before. So yeah, we always try and, fresh. I mean, it's also because it looks different, so it feels like you're moving on. But hopefully the freshening up comes from the story and the characters.
Before we move too much into the specifics of season three and looking ahead on the show, I wanted to just tag on to Chris's original question, which is, now it does seem like, as you said, it's a machine. You've got three seasons going at once in your head, potentially even future seasons being plotted. When did that become the project? What I mean to say is, you have these books, you were clearly a fan of them, there were already a number of them published, and you came into Apple, you put the project together. How quickly did it go from, let's see if we can pull off six episodes of this, to someone saying, you know what, we've got a great thing here, let's keep it rolling?
Let's see if we can do six
seasons. Well, I mean, it was quite a long process in sort of development, kind of always is, but originally it was Gail Mutrux in America, found the books there, where, because they didn't sell that well over here, but they sort of started to sort of get a little cult following in America. So it was Mixed American Publisher that kind of kept it going. It kind of got drops over here, and then it kept going in America. And then thankfully the UK caught up, and everyone realized, what brilliant books they are, what brilliant writer Mick is. And so Gail had it, but she knew that kind of a UK production company had to be involved. It's got a very kind of British sensibility. So she went to Seesaw, and Jamie Lawrenson, who was at Seesaw, had met up with me because I'd given him a spec script he really liked. And I think it was because of my background in comedy, and specifically, I think, working for Amadeo Iannucci on Thick of It and Veep, because the sort of shorthand pitch for Slow Horses it's kind of like Tinker Tailor meets The Thick of It. So it's got that kind of humor within it. In its DNA.
No wonder I like it so much.
Oh, really? Yeah. But that's why I responded to it, was like it had everything that I love. It's because I love Le Carré. Mick loves Le Carré. We're real fanboys with that. We went to see Le Carré do a reading together. They're like total fanboys. So it had Le Carré. It had a great action opening sequence that I thought was just absolutely brilliant. And then it had a twist on that action sequence that I thought was genius. And then you go into Slough House, and I kind of feel I've never seen anyone like this in spy fiction. Then you meet Jackson Lamb, and I kind of thought I've never met a character like that in any kind of fiction. And then all the other characters who felt really real and, you know, complicated home lives and kind of more everyday issues than you kind of get in the spy genre. And, you know, they're all this collection of vulnerable people. And the really smart thing I think Mick did with it as well is, by the very nature of Slough House, which is if you're in there, it's because you've messed up. Straight away, everyone has a backstory. Everyone has a flaw that you kind of want to know about and that you can mine. Plus, the books are really, really funny, but they're not spoofs. They're in the thriller section of the bookshop. They're not comedy books. They're thrillers, but the characters have a license to be funny because, you know, Jackson Lamb is a funny, acerbic, you know, witty character. He uses his humor as a tool. It's character-based. So it was all that mix of stuff just made my head kind of go, you know, wow, this is, you know, Mick has kind of reinvigorated the spy genre on the page. Let's try and do it on the screen. And then it was Apple, you know, going, yes, this seems great. And then it was Gary Oldman going, I'd like to do this. That was then like, oh, that just everyone goes, oh, all right, it's a thing then. And then you could get, you know, unlocks a lot of other cast getting someone like Gary. And it just makes it a prestige project. And then it was, you know, if we're going to do it, let's do it. And so that
I wonder whether or not there are some actors who do Slow Horses thinking this is finally my chance to work with Gary Oldman, and then they get there and it's Jackson Lamb
abusing them.
Yeah.
They do. I mean, he is, you know, I would say this to his face, you know, he's a revered figure, like, so of course everyone wants to work with him. But I just feel we're so lucky because we have so many revered figures in our cast. Jonathan Pryce is, you know, Gary, you know, is looks up to Jonathan. It's like he used to watch Jonathan on stage when he was starting out. And so I kind of think, I love the fact that we've got the kind of three generations of acting royalty in my head, the kind of Jonathan and Gary and Jack Loudon mirroring the kind of three generations of espionage royalty and kind of David Cartwright, Jackson Lamb and River Cartwright. And then you've got Chris Scott Thomas, Saskia Reeves, got Sophie Okonado in this, and it's just, these people are just incredible. So, yeah. Sorry, I'm just gushing about the cast.
Oh, no,
they
okay.
are amazing, and I just feel so lucky to work with
them. You mentioned, Will, your love of Le Carré and your work with Iannucci. I wondered specifically how then you found the line between those two great masters in this project, because Slow Horses, like Veep, it portrays a serious world in a way that at times is deeply unserious, or shows that world itself is or can be unserious. But this show also has, especially this season, giant machine gun fights. And I would venture to say that your bullet exit wound budget was quite robust in season 3. So how did you find that balance in creating the tone of the series?
It's quite a kill count.
It was quite surprising.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sort of, you know, a strange tone in some ways, but in others, I don't personally find it that unfamiliar. And I was never that worried about the tone being an issue, partly because Mick carries it off so brilliantly on the page. So I was like, well, Mick's done it, so we can do it. And then, you know, there's a whole, you know, bunch of films that were massively influential on me where I feel they're dramas and I absolutely believe every moment and every character in them, but they make me, every line is a brilliant joke, and just they make me laugh out loud. You know, With Nell and I is a massive film for me. Alexander Payne, particularly Sideways, Whit Stillman's Barcelona. You know, these are terrific film, these terrific comedy films, but you believe everything that's happening. And then also those great American dramas that again were a massive influence on me. If you look at, like, you know, Sopranos, Wire, Deadwood, The Shield, they have funny moments within them. The Sopranos could really go anywhere. I mean, if you look at the scenes with Tony and his mother in series one, that could read like sitcom. And James Gandolfini was one of the greatest actors of all time. He's a brilliant comedian, and you watch him in those scenes with his mother, and they're really funny. So, you know, shows can do this. You can kind of bend the tone. And then as well, of course, Armando had done that in The Thick of It and in Veep, where it's a comedy, but it feels real. And I really took with me something he said to me when we were doing, I think it was Veep, which is he cut a line in the edit, and he was just like, I just thought that actually in that moment, that character wouldn't be trying to be funny because something serious is going on. So, you know, it would have felt gratuitous. And that's what I really wanted to stick to on this, which is that as long as the line feels dramatically earned and that the character would say that thing at that moment, then you can be funny. And like I say, like Lam uses kind of humor as a kind of weapon at points to throw people off. So he's kind of got the license to do that. So as long as it feels true and it doesn't feel like you're doing a joke and you're shoehorning something in, you can kind of go anywhere with it. And then in regards with the action, that was a specific challenge to this series in that we knew we were kind of upping the action, and that, you know, as in the book, the kind of the back end of it is like a full-on, you know, gunfight in a Bond villain base, basically. But within that, we didn't want it to just feel like it was going into kind of another show. You wanted it to feel like you still had the humor and the character within the action. So they're still reacting like slow horses. That, you know, the guns aren't working properly. They're missing things. They're kind of, it's too loud for them. Whatever the thing is, it was to sort of try and find their personalities and be true to that within all the action.
I had a question about the sort of the project as a whole and adapting a long-running series like this. It's sort of a two-part question. One is, how do you find yourself balancing planting seeds for future seasons, future stories you're going to tell, and like maybe hinting that, you know, River's grandfather isn't doing the best right now and keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, staying in the moment with the story that you're telling and maybe allowing yourself a little bit of wiggle room narratively, creatively to change some things. And then my follow-up, which I'll just ask now, is also, do you keep the actors from reading ahead in the series so that they are kind of in the present tense with their characters when you're shooting a season?
That's a great question. And with regards to kind of how we kind of look at going forward, because we've got the books, we know what's coming up. So we knew, and it's a spoiler if you haven't read the books for season four, but if you had read the books, it's, you know, obviously, and if you've seen all of season three, River's grandfather is not doing so well. He's starting to kind of lose his grip on things. He started to succumb to dementia. And so, yeah, that was absolutely something we thought we have to actually prefigure that in series three. Otherwise, it might feel like it's coming out of nowhere. So, and also it makes for, it's one of my favorite scenes is Jack and Jonathan in the club with the tenderness and the pain that Jack's going through, and the kind of the awful realization that is dawning on David that he's starting to slip away. And in terms of reading ahead, I was watching them do that scene and just seeing what they did with it and how amazing they were, which is no surprise because it's Jonathan Pryce and Jack Loudon. And it gave me an idea for one of the final scenes of the next season, which I sort of went off and wrote off the back of seeing what they were doing there. And so a lot of the time, some of the actors, you know, read ahead of the book so they know what's coming, and some of them like to sort of wait and see, and you know, some of them are sadly dying in the books, so they don't care what happens in future seasons so much. But so with regards as to the deaths, they all know what's coming because we're very true to what Mick does, so we don't want to kind of mess with that. I think he judges that absolutely perfectly, and my feeling on killing characters is always that if the audience or the reader isn't bothered, then you left it too long. It should feel like a shock, and it should upset people. It shouldn't be like, oh yeah, you've probably done enough with them. So we don't tend to surprise them that much. Although we did surprise Freddie Fox, because in the books, it's actually Slime on Teeth that is on the bridge when River runs out after getting the kind of message about, you know, Catherine's going to die. And And that was actually, I'm going to give credit to Graeme Yost for that, because he was like, I've got a terrible idea. And I was like, what? And he said, spiders on the bridge. I was like, no, that's brilliant. That's fantastic. Because Freddie was so great. It was like in the books, he kind of, he's in a coma after the end of Deadlines. And then he kind of dies off page, really. And we just thought, let's give him a send off. Let's bring him
back.
Let's
really kill this guy.
Yeah. Go for it. One more time. Yeah, let's make him be an absolute asshole. And where could you go after that with him? Really, it's like, he's such a prick in this one. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but Will, I don't know if you were briefed ahead of time. You're actually speaking to the host of the number one Freddie Fox fan podcast, because his work in this season was so good that the amount of time we spent talking about him versus the actors who will continue on your show, proportion was way off.
I honestly feel bad for Jack Loudon. You know, like.
But Freddie is just, they're all brilliant. But Freddie in this season, just, and I knew he'd do it. I just knew, it's like, give him this and it'll be up there. And it was so operatic. But that's what the character is. He's not overdoing it. The spider is overdoing it. Freddie is judging it perfectly. He's just so funny. He's so repulsive in it. And just, he's a joy to work with. He's an absolute joy to watch. And just what a way to go out. But yeah.
And then there's no pleasure sweeter than killing him on screen, I guess. I wanted to ask specifically about that feeling
that he says, the gods are smiling on me today. And you're like, yeah, you're going to die. Yeah,
that's real McBain on The Simpsons. But
sorry,
moment.
Go ahead.
No, please. I think that one of the things that we love about the show is how thrillingly like vulnerable everybody feels outside of Jackson Lamb. You know, you have this deep bench of characters to draw from where people might show up, they might come, they might go, and you have this brilliant conceit that McHarran gifted you. It's not just that the characters have a backstory, it's that they have a shelf life, that they may not stay in Slough House for very long, whether they get called back up, whether they quit, whether they're fired, or in this case, whether they die. It also allows you to just sort of mix and match and discover things among scene partners, like Shirley and Marcus's entire journey, basically alone for this entire series of the show. Do you find yourself having a favorite character to write for, or a duo that you find yourself even like bending away from McHarran so you can get them isolated so you can create those sparks again?
Oh, no. I mean, it's favorites is definitely not. And one of the strengths of the book and of the cast is that when I'm reading the books, I'm never like, oh, it's them. Oh, get to the, you know, the characters that I like. There's no one I kind of want to skip past, but I definitely find, and it sort of happens once you start casting for me. And again, it's something I learned from Armando, that you start writing to the actors and to their rhythms. So I sort of see myself as a conduit between Nick's amazing work and the actor's interpretation of the character. And it's sort of blending that, because, you know, we have cast slightly differently from how they are on the page at points. And when you get, like Marcus and Shirley, for instance, there's an older dynamic in the book in terms of the sort of age difference. So they're more, you know, I think I'm right that it's sort of slightly more paternal, the relationship in book, where it's much more sibling because of the way we cast it. But those two, Kenneth Cohen and Amy Fionn Edwards, they're so brilliant at inhabiting those roles and running on after the, you know, if you need to like keep going, but if we need 30 seconds at the end, they can just do it. And I mean, Jack can do that as well. And Roz used to do that with Dustin Min, who we all miss. But and that's great when you feel like the actors are so in that zone that they can kind of do anything with it, which is always this sort of Gary level where there's that scene in F1 where he just goes in and orders a kebab. And I was watching it thinking, he's just ordering a kebab, but it's hypnotic. It's like, and he's acting with every cell of his body. It's just, you're just watching a real, it just feels like a real thing to me now when I watch him as Lamb. I'm like, that's not Gary, that's Lamb. So that's Gary. He's a chameleon like that.
Since you mentioned Gary and his chameleonic nature, I feel like it's important to ask about something I'm not sure how closely you pay attention to, but when this was season 3 premiered of Slow Horses, and you have the scene where Jackson Lamb goes to the doctor, Gary's body in this role became a source of a lot of internet fascination, where legitimate people were like, oh, this is CGI. They are making him look a certain way. And I'm thinking, Gary Oldman is probably the happiest he's ever been in his life, because he's eating kebabs and he can do whatever he wants and he's committed to the bit. So I guess couch in this question about him in his underwear on a doctor's table is probably a larger question about his commitment specifically to this role and how much he seems to relish playing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, he does. He absolutely loves it, and he gives it, you know, absolutely everything. And I mean, in terms of his physicality, he's definitely put on some weight as we've been doing it. But he also, he's bigger on camera because he does postural things where he'll sort of make himself look bigger. And I mean, I remember when we did the first Zoom read because it was COVID for series one, and I'd met him and, you know, we'd done some work on the scripts. And then on the Zoom read, he sort of did this thing with his chin where I was like, oh God, you've inflated your neck. And he looked, he'd sort of filled out as a land there, but he loves it. And that the scene where he's washing himself in the sink, unfortunately we had to do that twice because something about the film was corrupted. So we had to do it again. But he loved it. He was just walking around doing it really. I mean, he gets the joke. He loves being the character. It's not all CGI. And so, but he's also, it's, you know, he is properly transformative. That, you know, I was going to say he's a magician, but that implies there's no work, that he puts in a tremendous amount of work, and just, he knows the lines so inside out that he's not even, well, he is thinking about the performance. I'm tying myself in knots here. But what I want to say is he just becomes another person to the point where I can, like, if I caught him on Tinker Tailor a couple of months ago, and genuinely was like, that's not the same guy. That's a different man, because the stillness and the physique, and then everything about the voice, he does that. But Saskia as well. I mean, you know, I meet Saskia outside of the set, and I'm like, I have to double take. I'm like, because again, it's not just that they make her look older. She holds her body in a different way. She's another one way, or she just loves Catherine, and she's put so much thought and detail into what Catherine's doing, which I love, because my line on Catherine is always, yeah, everyone else in the room can overlook her and see past her, but the audience don't. That, you know, she's in those scenes and people are ignoring her, but, you know, you can see what she's doing and what she's thinking and, you know, how important she is.
I wanted to ask you about the character of London on the show, specifically this season, because there's some really fun meet me at the Barbican Bridge, you know, this, you have to get to this tube, you have to do this, you know, Catherine at the end of the series has got a 30-mile walk back to London. I'm going to ask you a question that I have asked Michael Mann about Los Angeles, which is, do you ever cheat? Do you ever cheat the London geography about, oh, he could or couldn't get there this fast, or this isn't actually close to where Slough House would be? Because I've tried to, when I've been in London, do the sort of slow horses tour.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun to walk by Regent's Park and think about everything that happens.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, we do cheat, and specifically, you'll have to remind me how far does Catherine say she's walking? Is it 20? She's walking 20 miles at the end of the city.
Yeah.
Specifically that, I can tell you that because I remember, because I think I'd put 20 miles, and then the people who work out, you know, where the locations are and the timings of everything, they were like, actually, where we've got the kidnap house, it would be 12 miles or 15 or something. And so I changed it to fit the reality of where we'd imagine the house was. And then it was, I'm pretty sure it was Gary was like, 20 miles is funnier. And it's funnier to say, it's further for her to walk. It's just better. And I was like, yeah, forget the reality. It's good. Stick with 20 miles. So we do kind of move it around a bit. But the Slough House, Slough House is a real exterior location. It's the location that Mick Herron used to walk past when he went to work before he was, you know, before he'd given up his day job, and he was, you know, just writing in the evenings. And so we're using the actual building that inspired Mick, which I absolutely love. We use a lot of the streets around there. So we try and stick to the sort of Slough House geography of it. But then when it comes to it, we just want whatever is interesting and unusual and hasn't seen before, doesn't see the obvious location. And our brilliant director, Saul Metstein, he's got a background in architecture. He did an architecture degree. And so he loves building. So he's got a great eye for that. And, you know, we have fantastic locations manager, Ian Pollington, who finds all these places that, you know, you don't normally see on camera. And a lot of people who live in London do remark on that as well, that, oh, it's good to see different side to the city on screen.
In the same way that I was just asking about London, I was curious about the world in which the way in which Slow Horses is sort of set of the world rather than in the world. So there's there are certain things that sort of echo our contemporary moment and current events, but it has its own sort of version of those events. And I wonder whether or not you're kind of, it's a relief to have that be the scenario rather than trying to keep up with the third prime minister of the year kind of pace with which current events go.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for reminding me that my country is in freefall. But yes.
Look who you're talking to.
It takes
to.
One to know one.
I know. Yeah, we're all
we have a special relationship, as you recall.
And Mick is very prescient. You know, he kind of one line that predicts Brexit in the first book, which I marvel at. And he, as books went on, he sort of brought in more. He's been commenting on contemporary events more and more, really. And he has the actual prime minister in certain books, and it'll always be a version of the sort of prime minister that he was writing at the time. And there's an absolutely amazing, I think it's Bad Actors, where he has a pastiche of a Boris Johnson speech, basically, which is absolutely the best satirical attack on Boris Johnson's speechifying that I've ever read, and that Mick said took him as long to write as it did to type, because he just sort of came out of him. So he's definitely, it's not satire quite, but it's he's drawing on and he's commenting on and he's expressing his frustration and his rage through his fiction. And that it's hard in drama. I think it would be very hard for us to ever show the prime minister, because like you could do it in the books because you don't see them, but I think once you put them on screen and you go, oh, that isn't actually the prime minister, I think for our show it would be tricky to suddenly start doing that, but you definitely feel their influence. And certainly Sam West, who plays Peter Judd, who's absolutely amazing, he's like an amalgam of all the shittiest politicians in Britain, that so you can kind of, it doesn't have to be a direct comparison, but you hint at it and you sum it up and we reflect it.
I think one of the, just as a fan of the show, one of the real creative pleasures you and your team must get to enjoy is the fact that season to season, you get to play in a different sandbox. And you were alluding before, Will, about how this season there was a remarkably high body count and suddenly you have a legitimately heavy action set piece that spans almost two episodes. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to the next season, which I know you're working on, and I know nothing's official, but we're hoping for many more seasons. Mm-hmm. What other types of storytelling are you looking forward to doing and seeing just how seaworthy this vessel you've constructed is?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely that, you know, it's wonderful to have a returning series, but where each series, because of the books, feels different. And just like on a really simple level, it's like Mick will, you know, like Slow Horses, that was in the winter, Dead Lions was in the summer, and that, you know, it's just you get the rain, then you get the sweltering heat, you just, so straight away you've got a different visual look, everyone's in different clothes, the lighting's different, everything, you know, everything can kind of, the look and the feel of it can shift. And then it's always obviously it's a different plot, but within that plot it's not just new villains, it's new Slow Horses, it's new everything. So as you say, he's got the body count. That means he's continually refreshing the kind of the cast for us and giving us these, you know, fantastic kind of casting opportunities. And also just the way he works, which is similar to the way Amanda used to work. You know, we'd start a season and he'd be like, all right, we're not doing that again. We've done that. What pairings of characters haven't we have? What's interesting? Like, they've been together. Let's split them up. Let's put them together. Let's see what that generates. And Mick, he would say this himself, I'm not speaking for him, it's his process that he's talked about. He will think, right, okay, what are the interesting pairings? Where are the characters at? What do I want to do with the characters? And then he'll sort of find a plot to fit where the characters are. So yeah, you look ahead, you know, like when I was, you know, I read, you know, all the books, you know, all the books that were available, you know, once I was committed to write a script for this, and you do think, oh my God, if we get to season three, I get to do the shootout. That was the real thing, you know, killing men. Not that I wanted to kill men, but as a moment, oh my God, that's going to be fantastic. There's things in book four that, you know, the opening, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe he's done that. Oh, how are we going to make that works brilliant on the page? How would we do that? Because that's tricky, because you'll know what I'm talking about when you finally get to see it, but there's a trick he does that you could do in the book, but it's hard to do visually. And the same with book five, actually. He's got a fantastic opening in that that you just couldn't do. So we have to sort of rethink that. So I'm continually thinking, and cast wise again, I'm happy to say there's two characters in series four where, you know, as I was reading the books, I was thinking, that would be amazing to get them and them, and we got them. that's really exciting to sort of from years ago to be thinking, oh, if we got to do that, I'd love to do it with them, and then to have done it is pretty amazing.
Well, I know that in other interviews, Gary has said that he'd like to play this role indefinitely. We'd like to, now that we have the opportunity to speak to you, can you commit to doing this indefinitely as well? Because I feel like, considering our countries are in free fall, considering everything is so uncertain, considering TV shows that we used to count on every year take 1, 2, 3 years off, death taxes and slow horses every fall is really helping us right
it
now.
It is so really reliable.
Can you make this promise to us?
It'll go on as long as Apple wants it, as long as Gary wants to do it. Like you say, he said he's happy for it to be his last. I mean, it's nuts just to even say that it's nuts to think of him not acting, and it's nuts to think that this would be the thing he'd go out on. It's absolutely incredible. But if Gary's
so
doing
you're
it,
responsible now. That means you have to keep writing, otherwise he stops acting. So this is really a you problem, not an us problem.
It's either you or Christopher Nolan's going to do a Harry Truman movie. It's got to be one or the other. Well, Will, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for making the show the way you do. It's just a source of really constant joy for Andy and I.
Yeah, and please come back and talk to us in future seasons.
Time. That's amazing to hear. And, you know, it's a really, you know, incredibly rewarding show to do. And I'm very lucky that I've worked on some things I'm very proud of, but I'm so proud of Slow Horses and keenly aware that, you know, I probably will never work on something as good as this again with a cast and a crew as amazing as this, because everyone, the amazing thing about it is that everybody is making the same show, which I know sounds obvious, but sometimes it's not the case. And it's like, everybody knows what it is, loves it, contributes, wants the best for the show. And it's just to feel that team is there is just an incredible feeling that I just don't want to ever have to let go of, because it's just amazing having that. And just with the cast, who is so in tune with the characters, have such great thoughts and such a delight. It's just, fantastic.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Well, happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you.